how far is too far when it comes to a PR stunt? Or perhaps more practically, how far can you push it to get people talking? What should you consider? What would you do if you were the PR manager for Elon Musk? And while many chief marketing officers say they'll be using influencers more this year, have the public had enough of them? And if so, what do you do about it? Welcome back to a new year of the Public Relations Podcast, the show where comms pros from in-house teams and independent agencies discuss giant killing campaign strategy.
The Public Relations Podcast with Richard Minson.
Welcome to 2024 and the Public Relations Podcast. If you've just had a break over the past few weeks, I hope you've had an absolutely wonderful time. If you've been working through it, though, well, here we go again. It is 2024. The show is back, and for now, we'll continue with the new format that I introduced last year. It seems to be going well. My goal, as always, is to prompt a discussion about ideas. So whatever format that takes is good with me. I think you probably all know by now that this is a hobby project for me that I do in my spare time. So let me know what works and what doesn't for you so that I don't waste my time on the wrong things. Tell me what the things are that give you the most value. It was... It's really nice to hear when you do have little comments. I mean, Frances Hawley, she's a Reuters and she does comms there, added this show to her Christmas advent calendar this year for things that have inspired her during the year. And that's absolutely wonderful. I'd love to know what is working for you too. You can always reach out to me on LinkedIn at Richard Midson. If you're new to this show as well, then basically as a journalist and as a PR over the years, I've seen a lot of claims over the years about what works and what doesn't work in PR. And I could be... a bit pig-headed, as you probably know if you've heard this show a few times. And I like to know what actually works in reality rather than what we'd like to work or what we think works. And that's why I get on the kind of plain-talking guests that I do, because I love having these sorts of discussions about what is practically working in the real world. I've got plenty of friends of the show coming back on this year and new people joining us, including one today. Before I introduce today's guest host, though, if you didn't hear last year's last episode, it was a really good one. We rounded up with TJ Ortega, who's a defense tech and public affairs officer with the United States Navy. And I love the case studies that we were looking at. We were looking at declining sports. How do you turn around a declining sport or some kind of activity where people have lost interest in it over the years? We were looking in this particular case at a whole lot of stuff going on around the World Rally Championship and how it used to be as popular as Formula One. It used to be a massively popular sport in the 1980s and how it dropped now. And one of the key lessons we got from that was the importance of listening to what the fans want and getting outside of the bubble of the sport. And we were finding that a lot of the ideas about how to revive the sport were probably sitting there right now on Reddit as we were going through some of those comments and looking at the things that fans wanted. Really interesting episode. If you didn't hear that, then make sure you listen back to that one. But do let me know what you think. What would you do to turn around a declining sport or activity as well as you've after you've heard that? Let me now introduce today's guest host, though. And I'm absolutely delighted to be joined by Kathleen Lucente, who is in lovely sunny Austin, Texas at the moment. A huge welcome to you. This is your first time on the show. I know a bit about you, but tell everyone about you.
Oh, thank you so much, Richard. It's a pleasure to be here. I am the CEO and founder of Redfan Communications, and we're a B2B tech PR firm here in Austin, Texas, with staff on both coasts in San Diego and in Asheville, and then in the middle, straight in the middle, Chicago and Dallas. So we're very excited.
You've got plenty of tech going on there.
Yeah, it's just booming. It's interesting to think of Asheville, North Carolina, too, as being one of the seventh fastest growing areas in the country. You know, people sort of are always chasing where's it going to happen next. And so we like to kind of check that out. But we've been around about 15 years. And so it's just celebrating that this year.
We've just been discussing some of your travels around the world as well from all kinds of different countries over the years doing PR too. And I really want to bring some of that into it later in the show because there's so many different perspectives. I love that you can bring to this stuff. It's going to be really interesting.
I had the benefit of, kind of my PR, being a high-tech journalist who jumped into PR because Motorola here in Austin, Texas, told their PR agency in Boston to hire me because I could translate semiconductors to your grandmother as well as the New York Times or the FT. And then from there, you know, wound up in New York City, worked at IBM Research in charge of that, and then was at JP Morgan, where I wind up helping through the 9/11 issues, obviously, in there, and then moving to Hong Kong to kind of deal with a four-way merger that was brewing there across 18 countries for the agent, for the investment bank. And so I was there for 3 months and it turned into 5.5 years. And it was an absolute spectacular thing to have experienced.
It's so interesting, though, to hear the different perspectives when it comes to PR. It's a guest of mine coming on next week. She's from Mumbai. So we're going to have an Indian perspective on PR. And I just think it's always fascinating hearing from different people from different countries, because it's like we've talked about, I think, before, with storytelling is so important, but ultimately the story will adapt based on cultural sensitivities and, of course, the target demographic you're reaching out to. And you must have seen that a lot with the different places you've worked in.
Absolutely. And in fact, there are many times where we were, you know, instituting media training for all the executives in 18 countries and really getting people to understand that there's a reason why we have to follow processes to mitigate risk. And there are many times where I found myself cleaning up a misstep that somebody decided to throw their own press conference 2 weeks into my role in Asia. Or I got a call right after 9/11 asking if we could bring all the US companies together in Pakistan for like a, you know, a sort of a happy thought. And I thought, no, I don't think we can. And so just, you know, helping people, their heart was in the right place, but helping them understand, well, what are you trying to achieve and how do we actually make that happen? And then what are the cultural sensitivities that we need to factor in? And then factoring the other part that you're part of a global firm and whatever you do here will trickle through to the Financial Times and then the Wall Street Journal. And it is not isolated.
Yeah, how it's being interpreted in different places. Do you remember, I mean, I'm putting you a little bit on the spot here, but do you remember one of the most awkward moments with that kind of cultural sensitivity? I mean, you don't have to go into detail and name anyone, but does one stick in your mind and one of the challenges you had to deal with?
One of my probably favorite challenges was, well, there's so many good ones. But one was we had a head of the investment bank decided to throw a press conference in Korea and with his clients and invited a bunch of reporters and had refused to go through media training. And what happened was he had Bloomberg there and they misspoke, but they couldn't retract. And next thing I know, I was getting a phone call. I was only a month in Asia. I was getting a phone call saying, Kathleen, can you help us? Can you help us? Can you get this Bloomberg reporter to change this? It will ruin the multi-million dollar deal that we're about, you know, trying to sign. And I said, I can't retract if you said something, if it's not accurate, like we have to get on the phone. And I got the client, his client, him, myself, and the head of Bloomberg at the time on the phone. And I was able to show the power of why you need to do things properly. And we were actually able to get the story corrected.
Well done.
Now, could not promise that, but I could show him this is somebody who has pull. And so from then on, it was like whatever Kathleen says goes. And similarly, we had a fellow in Australia who decided to sue the Sydney Morning Herald and went to an outside lawyer without going to our own lawyer over something that was said, you know, that was he didn't like. And so I had to fly down and clean that up. So lots of little interesting things that you never saw the light of day of. I have a little cartoon of myself with a little, a fire outputter outer. It's a cartoon that my staff has that of all the things that we've, you know, basically killed so you never see the light of day. But there were some interesting things. But they brought those executives together. So they started to really understand why you want to work with corporate communications and that we're not here to hinder you. We're here to actually empower you and get the stories out that you want.
I think one of the problems you often hear, and plenty of people I've spoken to on this show, said the problem with what we do is that people don't realize the value until it's too late.
A lot of times. I mean, I often find ourselves, you know, with clients who might be going through a merger or an acquisition, and we've always told them, please tell us really far in advance so we can get in. But a lot of times, companies are like, oh, let's not spend the money on these outside partners or let's not involve people or waste their time. But actually, it winds up creating more problems and more time if you don't bring in your key advocates, your trusted advisors early on and the right mix of people.
The problem is how do you sell that? I mean, this is another thing we've been talking about a lot on the show is that PR has a bit of a PR problem. How do you get people to realize that when they haven't felt the pain of it yet? I mean, people buy things because they feel pain. If they haven't felt the pain, it's hard to sell them something, isn't it? I mean, how do you explain to people before they get to that point the value of what you're doing?
Traditionally, I help them understand a couple of things. We'll talk to internal communications and external communications. So we'll talk to the head of HR to see what was the latest poll on employee like happiness if before a merger, right? And now you're about to add more humans to that mix. So if people were already not very happy and you're about to add another mix, you now need to not keep doing what you were doing, but take this unified group and say, hey, we're a new company with this new, you know, we want to hear from you, and then hit the reset button and understand how they want to digest information. My big belief in good PR is that if you don't have your internal audience on board and fanning on you, you will be found out.
You're going to them and you're saying, look, here's the data of what we've got. This is what happens, in quotes, every time that you have a situation like this. This is what's going to happen. It may not, but there's a very good chance it will. We need to do X now. Is that kind of what you mean?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We'll come in and actually do a refresh on mission, vision, values, but with data, not just in a bubble or in a vacuum, but a real engagement with employees to understand and then bring that data to the CEO and the C-suite and say, and maybe if it's a merger, bring the emerging executives into the equation and say, okay, we've pulled this information because I know you don't want to lose this staff. That was the whole point of the asset of this acquisition. So let's make sure we're creating synergies and we're showing them within the first 30, 60, 90 days that they're the most important thing, not the press. And then, you know, we're doing the press as well. But if you're just talking to the press outside and you haven't spent the time to nurture and also create a listening panel to hear what people's concerns are, they will find a way to express that on, you know, anywhere, any communication channel that they prefer, cocktail party, LinkedIn, Reddit, you know, whiteboard in the conference room, you know, can't stand this place, whatever it may be. You want to make sure that they feel really engaged.
So you've got the evidence from the past, haven't you? That's what sells it.
So important. And I use the example, even when I was at JP Morgan, I was much younger then and I didn't appreciate it as much, but I do really, when JP Morgan and Chase merged, one of the things that they did was they handed out a book called Who Moved My Cheese? And it was really, it's a book about getting used to change, that, you know, we're in a different place as a globe, as businesses. Change happens faster at companies than it did, you know, 40 years ago when our parents were in companies and people stayed in companies where you had the sense of trust for, you know, you're going to be there for 25, 30 years. Yeah. Change is normal and we should be okay with it. We need to know how to ride it and ride it to our advantage. And that's something that...
humans are slow to change, aren't they? That's the problem. And that's where you're needed to be able to manage.
And fear.
We can talk about this forever. Let's get on with the... I feel funny to say, let's get on with the show after 13 minutes. But we could talk forever. This is the problem, isn't it? We'll have to get you back on another day, Kathleen.
Anytime.
Yeah. Well, let's start the main things we were looking at. Let's start with some of the things that we spotted this week. And the first one, there seems to be a flood of articles recently about influencer fatigue, where the public are claimed to be getting tired of influencers. According to Influencer Marketing Hub, 50 million people worldwide now identify as influencers, with 43% of communications teams reportedly saying they're relying more on influencers than ever this year. It raises the question, what to do if the public are no longer interested, or if the problem is not with influencers, but the way they are being used. To me, personally, and I'm going to be really interested to hear what Kathleen thinks of this, my feeling is this is not about influencer fatigue, it's about authenticity fatigue. You know, a real influencer doesn't feel like an influencer or probably doesn't even need to describe themselves at it. What's your thought on that? Influencer fatigue? Do you think it's real?
I do believe influencer fatigue is real. And I think there's a difference in different categories. So in the B2C world, there is a huge fatigue. I have friends who work in that space and Airbnb and other areas. And even in the past years, even like 3-4 years ago, they were complaining and whinging about this one couple wants, you know, $500,000 for 3 posts. And where do you cap this off? Where does this end? So then they went for the micro influencers. And it just is an endless docket there. The reality is that on the B2B side of the world, what we're seeing, and Trust Radius just came out with some research on this as well, is that B2B buyers really want to do their own homework and they're looking exactly for those authentic feedback loops. They don't want bought, influencers. They do not want something that was paid for. They're in search of, and they will do their homework, you know, very, very deeply. And I think that's true for really strong consumers as well. I think consumers are starting to realize, you know, it's one thing to buy a set of eyelashes, you know, because somebody batted them and they looked fabulous on that person on their Instagram. But the question of how much money was that influencer paid and how many lashes were they sold?
I think the problem also, though, is that you know those influencers who are just recommending one product after another.
100%.
And so often it's, okay, that's not my kind of thing, the fashion influencer thing. No. I'm not following that kind of person. But it's like when you're watching them, it just sticks out.
And well, then, it's inauthentic.
Someone, I mean, we did something a couple of weeks ago about pharmaceutical influencers and how it's not, yes, you've got that sort of market where you've got the, in quotes, the mum who's got the child with the disease, who's talking about what they do and homeopathic remedies and stuff like this. And then you've got your academic or your scientist who has been doing this for sort of 30 years and has the research. And you've got two very different types of approach to influencing.
That's true.
And so that's very different from your makeup influencer who is talking about a different product every day.
And it's the same thing. So with the B2B tech space, what we do is we look for industry analysts to brief, right? Because they're not going, you can't buy them. We're going to do a recommend a trust radius where people have to write in, customers have to write in their reviews. You can't edit them and all that kind of stuff. So you're looking for these third party opportunities that are not bought. And that is super, super important. What last year in the B2B space, people put a lot of money into their own content, but they kind of shrunk back from doing analyst relations and media relations even to probably keep their budget tight. The reality though is then there's not as much out there to go out and do your own homework. So that makes the B2B shopper have to go and call people, ask people, hey, have you worked with them? They have to work harder to get validation that you're the right choice. And so if you're in marketing and PR, you want to really help those companies get pump that up so that there are more authentic. It takes more time, but it's well worth it.
But it's the education side, isn't it? Of what it sounds like you're really focusing on, educating people rather than giving them a bunch of money to give some standard branded line, which that's the bit I think people are tired of.
It's very true. And I think also we work in the medical cannabis space as well. So in Texas, we have a major client that is trying to work with, we work with lobbyists and we're trying to change law. So in those cases, there's nothing, first of all, there's lots of law around what you can or can't do with cannabis online. So we have doctors, much like your healthcare example, we have doctors who are can talk about the influence on PTSD, on children with epilepsy. We have families that come in and we'll do case studies. And that's really helping to change the mind and opinion of legislation, as well as, you know, families who are thinking, why is my Uncle Jack taking, you know, cannabis, right? They might have a blurred feeling about it. Or people who are embarrassed to say they're even doing it. Maybe a cancer patient who is in their 60s or 70s and would never have even thought about using cannabis, but is doing it and is much better as a result of it.
There was a really interesting case study we had a lot earlier last year on the show with this, with medicinal cannabis. And they were talking about getting case studies on and putting them forward to the press. And the situation they had was that they had a case study who they felt was absolutely perfect. But the person, they were trying to reach kind of a white middle-aged men with their message. And the case study they had was someone who they felt was really good at talking, could explain it well, had a clear situation where it had helped them. But the person was covered in tattoos and was quite young. And the problem there you had was that this disconnect, because the people that you were trying to reach are going to look at that and go, well, that's the kind of person that would take cannabis. They're a druggie.
Yeah, and people make assumptions. Yeah,
exactly. Well, this is the reality, isn't it? Whether we like it or not, this is the problem with PR, isn't it? Is that people are making these assumptions. And it's like, so the challenge then was trying to find a case study that would match these people and they could relate to.
Yeah, what we did was, or a client worked with a partner that created a film, and it had a young lady who was white, middle class, could never go to a sleepover party, could never learn to drive, could never get any license, and now is graduating from college and wants to become a lobbyist. There was a Hispanic family that, you know, it costs a lot of money, them talking about what they had to give up in order to do this. And then an extremely wealthy, fairly white family in Texas that, you know, it doesn't matter how much money they have, they can't help their son with epilepsy with any medication other than this. And so by having that dynamic, it really, really helped a lot. And I think that you can't rely on one case study to reach the different types of audiences you're trying to reach. Sure. And by having those three together, it also for legislature to be able to see, wait a minute, I just assumed a certain type of party would use this kind of medication. It just helped to abolish that straight up. So that was really high
impact.
Right,
let's move on to the next story. This is one you spotted about Zara. Tell us a bit more about why you thought this was a good example.
Well, I mean, you have Zara really did not do a strong risk assessment on their advertising campaign, which is, if anyone has gotten a chance to see it, was basically photos that kind of evoked some things with the war that we're seeing in Israel right now, the issues with Gaza. And it was evoking some imagery there that they didn't really take an assessment of that. And they launched it and they should have had sort of additional feedback looking at it and never launched it.
These were images, weren't they? They had kind of mannequins dressed in clothes. And then around those the sort of fully clothed mannequins, they had mannequins that were broken and split right. up across the floor, didn't it? It kind of looked like, to put it bluntly, a bomb site with
an exploded
just the
human
nice modeling clothes in the middle hole. Yeah,
right. And that juxtaposition of that imagery made quite a few people who are huge Zara fans really speak up and say this is, you know, appalling. So today, Zara has now, if you look in their Instagram, has an apology. One of the things though, when I read their apology, it didn't feel like an apology. It didn't feel like a message of accountability. And I think that it didn't feel as strong as I would have written it. There are steps that they need to take moving forward. And we love that a company like that wants to take bold moves, artistic moves and things of that nature. But it reminded me of back in 9/11, the Ninja Turtle movie that came out. So the Ninja Turtle movie was had plenty of time to make adjustments, but on 9/11, the actual date of 9/11, they launched their movie poster and it had the Ninja Turtles falling out of a burning skyscraper.
Oh,
and so, you know, this gets back to what I call this risk assessment. And a lot of people don't do it, but you have to do it with every campaign and you have to do it literally up to the day of, right? We all know if you've been in PR, say you're pitching something, if you haven't read the news that morning and you're pitching something and there's been a major air crash, the journalists are going to say, why are you calling me? I mean, you cannot be a numbhead. It doesn't matter. You have to do that level of assessment. And that's really important. And I don't think that they really did that. They didn't think about it.
One of the challenges, I mean, with that Ninja Turtles thing, it's just incredulous that anyone could even think that was right to release that day. But it's like you sometimes think, well, with things like this, did someone go, that looks like an interesting artistic image? And that there are wars, there's violence going on around the world all the time. And they just didn't connect the two. So it's like, at what point? There's always going to be someone offended by something, isn't there? So at what point do you say too many people will be offended compared to the impact that what you're doing is going to achieve?
Well, I mean, I think that you need to have a couple of different people involved. So sometimes the creative team might get so absorbed in the process that they've lost that critical lens. And a media relations person would come in and say, here's the kind of images we're seeing in the press all day. So, maybe they would look at that. So you would bring in a couple different people just to do that kind of risk assessment.
But how do you draw that line? That's what I mean. That's the difficult thing, isn't it?
You have to draw the line. You have to draw the line.
Yeah.
Well, you have to draw the line. Like Nike with the take a knee.
Yeah.
They they did a risk. I believe they did a risk assessment, and they decided they were willing. They understood their audience well enough that they were willing to lose some people along the way and still make a really strong statement. So the question of the Zara artistic direction was, what was the statement they really were trying to make? Yes. And unfortunately, because it wasn't outlined very clearly with a strong campaign, it was left for a lot of interpretation. And in this environment right now, we don't have as much room for or resilience around that, I think. And so it's they withdrew it. I think they'll recover from it. They have a good conversation with their consumer regularly. This isn't something that they've done egregiously multiple times. So I think they'll learn from it and hopefully just think things through a little bit more so moving forward.
It's an interesting story. Moving on to Elon Musk, the man who keeps giving. Elon Musk has been creating headlines again, this time telling advertisers to go away. Well, actually in slightly more aggressive language than that. It follows controversy over a tweet he made and the fact that major advertisers such as Disney have been pausing or withdrawing their campaigns from Twitter, stroke X, whatever you want to currently call it. But as usual with this show, we're not interested so much in the people, but the strategy behind it. And it must certainly gives us plenty to talk about from a PR point of view. So what can we take from this latest incident and how could it have been handled differently? Do you want to start this one, Kathleen?
100%. So I think Elon Musk is a unique character overall. And because one of the things that he did that makes it hard for any PR person to step in and fix this is that when he took over X, he abolished the board, which is a safety net. He abolished his PR team, right? And so he abolished all the things that are the safety nets that a normal CEO would have to help him along this journey. And so it's an interesting thing. So right now he's being held accountable. He was trying not to have anyone to be held accountable to. And now he's being held accountable by groups that he can't control. So advertisers and such. So one of the things that you normally would do is the moment a CEO like that would make a step in it kind of situation like that is that you would absolutely get your communications team together and get a statement out of accountability and fixing it immediately. And you would also have your head of advertising. He is an incredible woman who's the head of advertising, who is very well respected. Yeah. And you would also start to think about how do we put the safety measures in place to make sure this never happens again? Who is allowed to post on X from the executive team? When is that happening? Is there approval process? What are the risk factors when we allow a CEO just to go rogue? You know, it could be that we lose all of the revenue to our company in a swift
move. One of the challenges you've got with Musk is that he seems determined to speak up whatever happens. So in a way, I mean, part of my thought on this is a little bit, it's like, well, okay, Mr. CEO, what is your goal? Is your goal to make money? Is it to run Twitter as a ongoing money-making business? Or is it to use it as a platform for you to speak up and say whatever you want?
Yes, because that's really important to know.
It's
important.
Yes, exactly. It's crucial to know the goal, right. Isn't it?
Yeah. Is this a science? Is this a sociology or science experiment for you? And you don't care if it goes bust, like an investment that it didn't work out.
And if that is the goal, then so be it.
But then I think his head of advertising and all the people around him need to know that to determine, because their reputation is also associated with those decisions. And I think that that's a really important thing. I know that his head of advertising, people in the industry are begging her to step down and step far away. And she's thinking she can nurture him along through this.
She's really tried, hasn't she?
She really has. And, I think she's probably going to have to put a stake in the ground about what would make her stay. Advertising's a big part of what makes X possible. He either has to agree or disagree with that, and then she can decide if that's going to be, something she wants to take on.
Do you think there's traditionally a compromise position that you could come up with? I mean, I get the feeling that Elon Musk is not going to stop giving his opinion.
Yeah, I think he's vocal. I mean, I liken him to, ironically, how Trump, had to have his Twitter account closed down because it just got so out of hand, right? So Now, there is some, you know, it doesn't matter what you think in terms of like or don't like, but you do need to recognize, I mean, I've seen people go too far. So I think of Trevor Milton, who was at a company here in the United States, who went way too far on Twitter and was talking too far off message, was inflating his stock, went berserk. His board actually tried to stop him and create a penalty if he, you know, did certain things. He's in jail today. So, you know, it's understanding what are the risk factors for our friend Elon Musk. He, you know, the question is, has he met his match? Is he going to be able to get what he really wanted out of this investment? What was the goal?
And what, that's the thing. Unknown. That's what it keeps coming to for me is, what was the goal, wasn't it? You know, what does he want? If he wants to use it as a platform for speaking up, then so be it. But he's just got to accept the fact that it may be the most expensive mouthpiece anyone's ever bought.
But the other thing is, if you think about risk management on this, and risk mitigation and just evaluating it.
Yeah.
Things I don't know that he really truly understands is, what is the impact this has on SpaceX? What is the impact this has on Tesla?
Yeah.
And do people want to be associated with somebody who would make those types of comments on Twitter? So he might dismantle things he doesn't even realize he's dismantling. And those companies have boards and have more checks and balances. So when I talk about risk management, before he opens his mouth or types a tweet, he should probably be thinking a little bit about, even if it's just a greedy factor, you know, do I want to lose my other two companies in the midst of this?
It's a difficult one, isn't it, is to get that line, because it's like with Tesla, he developed this real environmental, saving the planet, innovative, thinking out there, blue sky thinking brand. Everyone was flocking to it. It was hard to disagree with it. And then he comes along with this, and that's really polarizing opinion. And then you think, well, okay, what is the kind of the message that you can put out? I mean, I'm trying to think off the top of my head, you know, what is the line? In a way, it's kind of, the only thing he can say is that we've got a platform. You can reach your customers on it by supporting X, you're not supporting a particular point of view or something around that. I think you've got to work on the actual message. But that's the only thing I think you can say, isn't it? To try and disassociate. But he's tried to do that. I don't really know what else you can say to disassociate the two.
Well, I mean, even the former CEO of now X as Twitter would go on and every once in a while would step on it, but not to this degree. But you know, he kept an open dialogue. It wasn't a one-way talk. And what Elon is doing is much more of a, it's my way or the highway. And that is not opening up dialogue. So it's just a big question mark as to what is it that he wants to do? I mean, he flew to Israel to try to make amends, but then he's arguing with his advertising folks. He didn't really completely retract what he said. So I don't think, you know, if we were ranking him on the likability score right now, I don't think he'd be getting a lot. And I think if I were on the board of Tesla and I were Jewish or some, you know, I might be taking issue. And even if I'm not Jewish, if I, you know, if I just have any empathy, I would probably be taking issue with,
from a financial point of view, let alone ethics, from a pure financial point
just,
of view.
Yeah. There's a whole bunch of things there. And so this is also, you know, he buys his way into things and creates them. And it's hard to invite somebody to, you know, events that you're not sure what they're going to do. Sort of he's the wild card guy. So I would love to know what is his 5-year plan? Like, you know, what is he trying to do with this mouthpiece? You know, does he hope to have a political role later in life?
What is the clear goal? Not just even like with Elon Musk, but I think you often get this with people, is that they don't really know what they're trying to achieve with their PR, with their marketing, whatever. And unless you've got a clear idea, it's just not going to work.
Well, I look at it as if I have a CEO that's out on Twitter making flippant comments like that, I'd think, you have too much time on your hands. Let's get you to work on some things that really matter.
Yeah.
Because look, you know, 5 minutes out of your day just caused you weeks and weeks of headache. And you're in the press for all the wrong reasons. So, you know, I can't imagine that it feels good. it might be a sense of stubbornness on his part, but having a trusted advisor who can sit down and get him past that, it's probably a good next step.
Lots of good stuff in that. If you would like to be a guest on the Public Relations Podcast, which of course you can find on all good podcast platforms, and also now it's a bit of an experiment on YouTube. Most people are listening to this on audio, but you can find us on YouTube now. You can see our smiling faces on there with Kathleen Lucente from Red Fan Communications today and myself, Richard Midson. You can see our links. Actually, you should say just quickly, Kathleen, where people can find you. Still got a bit more of the show to go, but how can people get
absolutely audio? You can find me at redfancommunications.com or Kathleen at redfancommunications.com. I'm also on LinkedIn. And if you join our newsletter on our website, you'll get the VIP newsletter I send out to CEOs.
Awesome. And you can find me, Richard Midson, M-I-D-S-O-N, on LinkedIn. And of course, the publicrelationspodcast.com. Right. I always love to ask our guests about a campaign that they have been working on recently, just to sort of see what kind of things they are learning from the way that the world of PR is changing all the time. What can you give us an idea of a campaign you've been working on particularly recently, Kathleen, and some of the things that you're seeing that are new in particular?
Absolutely. I think in the last, I would say, year and a half, I've been working on quite a few private equity deals and M&A deals. And most recently, we helped to bring one of the largest fintech core companies from going from public to private and with a PE firm. And they are extremely well funded, and there were no reasons other than that the CEO really did not like being on the alternative exchange. And his goal eventually is to be on the New York Stock Exchange. And so he wanted to take a step back. And so we helped them reposition, get where they need to be. And then we're helping them grow with additional mergers and acquisitions to fill in the gaps where they might need additional support. And through that process, we also did all the internal comms. So we came up with, words on a wall don't mean anything. But if one of the things we like to do with values is take those values and talk about, well, how does this come to life every day in your company? And what are ways you don't want to see it coming out? So the do's and the don'ts of a value, each single one. And we had him introduce them back out to the company and then bring them to life with his head of HR and head of communications. And that's been hugely, hugely successful. And we'll continue to do that because as you add more employees, you really want to make sure people feel truly bonded to the mission, vision, and values. And it has some level of meaning, right? But we've also been taking that company. When you're a public company, there's certain press that you get regularly because you're a public company. So the bigger challenge when you go private is really keeping that press engine alive and the analyst relations engine alive as well. And so we've been able to continue to keep that going in a really, really strong way. And I'm seeing more fun deals coming around the corner in 2024 for them, for sure. I think we're going to continue to see really strong growth. And it's helped position our head of communications at that company. She was already a rock star, but it's really given her the trusted partnership that she needed that wasn't just doing media relations, but was looking at how do we take media relations and really keep it at the level that the public companies are getting, which is not easy. So you've got to get real creative there. And then how do you also take internal communications and make your employees ambassadors who are really excited to be out talking positively about your company?
I really want to pick up on two things here. The first one was the values, because we so often hear companies talking about values and nothing happens with them. So how did you translate a word on the wall into something that actually meant something tangible?
Well, we actually said, okay, well, how does this, if this value is important, how do you see that come to life in a sales conversation?
So what does it mean, in other words?
Yeah.
I mean, can you give us an example of a word even, Candy?
Well, I could give, so I'll give you one of mine in particular. Yeah. So one of mine is fire in the belly.
Yeah.
So my expectation with my employees when they're talking to our clients is to have a fire in their belly about their industry, about what's going on with them. And I'm also looking for clients who have a fire in the belly. I don't want somebody who's like, well, I don't really feel it. I'm just doing this because I have to, right? Well, who wants to drag someone up a hill?
Yeah,
not me. So you're really looking for that fire in the belly. And that means there's some days people aren't going to have the best energy, but most of the time this industry, you have to have that. You have to be really ready to go. And so we look at, what does that look like in a new business meeting? How do we bring that to life? What does that look like and how we're engaging with our clients each week? What is the wow factor we're bringing to the table every month? You know, it's going above and beyond what their expectations are. So we're not telling them that we
have tangible though, because you know, you can come up with strategies and plans like this around phrases, and it very quickly gets lost, doesn't it?
Well, we have two different things. We have two things. We have a Monday meeting where we talk about what are the wow goals we have for each client, and how are we going to achieve those wow goals. And then I have on a monthly basis a thing called the raving fans score. So we have our clients scoring us, and we're scoring them internally to see, you know, are we using their budget as effectively as we had hoped? Are we getting the engagement that we wanted? What if they were to grade us right now on a scale of 1 to 5, what would that be? And then if we see any, you know, areas that are concerning, we have action items immediately to address them.
Excellent.
So it's about creating you can't be all talk. You have to put the muscle and the accountability systems in place able to do that. Yeah, 100%.
The other one was employee advocacy thing, because this is something that is becoming more and more popular as well, isn't it? Trying to get your employees on board with it. How have you approached that now? And how do you think that's perhaps changed in the past few years now that every employee, as you said earlier, can speak up? Everyone could go viral.
That's true. The main thing is that companies have to invest more in internal communications to begin with. I think that they've been pretty flippant about it. A lot of times companies do not even give their head of communications a sliver of budget to actually execute on it. So a great example would be you have to create different systems. I was with a partner the other day, and they run a podcast for a huge, huge tech company. And it's an internal podcast for the sales team, because the turnover in sales teams are so high in companies. And it's because they're out on the road, they feel disconnected. It's easy to, you know, fall in love with another company or get snatched up. But this podcast is run by one of their heads of sales. He's got a big personality. He brings on customers that have really felt good about the engagement, talks about like the Monday blues in sales. And really, the sales team can listen to it on the road, and they feel like they're part
of
something.
It's relatable.
You know?
It's actually talking to them, isn't it?
Right. Yeah. It's specific. So that's a segment. It's not, if you are not in sales, you're allowed to join it. It's not that you're not allowed to join it, but it really is made for sales.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing. So a lot of times in companies, the tech group doesn't feel very, you know, loved, right? So when I was at JP Morgan Chase, one of the things I realized was our chairman had a lot of really important executives getting on the elevator, going up to his office on the top floor, like John Chambers when he was the head of Cisco and things like that. And I asked, hey, would you mind if I asked their communications person if when CEOs are coming, we can snatch them up and bring them over to Lab Morgan and they can talk to the entire tech staff about what they see happening in the industry? When you're a coder in a company and you get access to that, you go home going, yeah, man, I got access to things that, so it's changing this mindset of like, oh, only important people get to hang out with important people. It's what is the value that you're bringing? How are you enriching the lives of the people that work for you? And how are you thinking about the things that you do regularly that maybe you need to open up and change? And so these are some creative ways to do that.
Awesome. We're going to have to move on because we are running out of time. Right, let's just hit this one quite quickly. This was two stories that hit the headlines in the past couple of weeks, which raised the question as to how far should you go with PR stunts. A few weeks ago, Trevor Jacob, a former Olympic snowboarder, was sentenced to 6 months in jail after he strapped cameras to the light aircraft that he was flying and then bailed out in mid-flight. He recorded the ordeal, with a selfie stick and parachuted to safety. This video, posted in December 2021 under the guise of an accident, was part of a product sponsorship deal. It went viral, amassing almost 3 million views. But skepticism arose due to Jacob's preparedness with the parachute and his failure to attempt a safe landing. Now, the second story may sound very different, but there are strong parallels. A few weeks ago, Omid Scobie, a relatively unknown author covering the royal family in the UK, faced controversy over his book Endgame. In its Dutch translation, the book named King Charles and Catherine, Princess of Wales, as the individuals who allegedly discussed the skin colour of Prince Harry and Meghan's unborn baby. Now, Scobie insisted the naming was an error and blamed the translators, although how the names were left in the material given to the translators is anyone's guess. The publisher withdrew the Dutch version for rectification, they said, but while Scobie has reportedly received death threats, his name and the book have gained plenty of publicity, more than any marketing campaign probably could have. So both were clearly publicity stunts, whether intentional or not. Both were PR in a sense. We don't discuss ethics so much on this show, as other shows cover that well. We focus on the technique. But while we won't talk about what is morally right, it does raise this question as to how far you can go before it backfires and damages your reputation. I mean, there's a bunch of things that you could talk about here. I mean, any initial thoughts on that one, Kathleen, from you?
I went back and looked at both of these, and it's interesting with the first with Trevor. You can barely even find the company he was associated with. It made me wonder how much money they paid to scrub their name out of it, which is quite interesting. So I would say that the company that decided to do this stunt with him probably did not expect him to go rogue, but they did know that they were taking some risk, right? So the question of risk mitigation, what were they expecting? What could they have had written in the contract that said, if you do anything further than what has been promised, you'll get no payment whatsoever? The fact that the plane actually crashed in a national park. I'm sure there was a huge fine that we're never finding out about that somebody had to pay for. So the risk mitigation of, you know, if you're a company that's used to, like a skateboarding company or something that's used to, you know, bringing, you know, wild activities, you are expected to do some pretty cool stuff. The question is, every time you have to sit down and go, what are our values? If this goes well, what does it look like? If it goes badly, what does it look like? And are we willing to get sued? Some companies are willing to get sued. Mm. They say, hey, I'm fine.
Yeah, for the public, it's the cost of the marketing. Yeah.
It's just the cost. But in this case, you had somebody who created brand damage enough that you can barely find the brand now when you go back and look, which tells me that that brand probably had to pay a lot of money, and that's hard to do, to get scrubbed out of the news. So right there, that's a huge one. I think with the author, he also, and the publishing company, needed to be looking at the risk for them, right? While there's a lot of publicity, a lot of those books got pulled and scrapped. He might make great sales in the short term. He might get sued in the short term. Not sure who's going to protect him other than the lawyer he claims he spent hours and hours with to make sure this was legit. Okay. I think that one, it's a short-term gain, long-term foul. Who will want to ever be interviewed by him again? What trust is there ever again?
I don't
know.
I mean, with Scobie, I kind of feel like that was a big hit. But the fact that his name is out there now and journalists will have heard of him and there's a potential for more controversial stories in the future from him, I can see how newsrooms would be curious about him now. And if they'd never heard of him before, I mean, I'd never heard of him before.
I'd never heard of him before, but having done some homework on him, I think that the question is, what was his long-term goal? Does he want to be a gossip columnist, or was his plan to, what kind of journalism or authoring of books does he hope to do in the next 3, 5, 10 years? And certainly, what access will he have to royalty in the future?
Well, he's not going to have any access to royalty. Well, no, he's not. Clearly not.
Anyone who wants to talk about other sort of
salacious books or anything like that, I'm sure it's going to raise his profile a bit on that. But as you say, what's his what's his goal again, isn't it?
Yeah. And if you're the publisher, I also, you know, they're also taking a bit on the nose. The question is, did they, you know, did they knowingly do this thinking, oh, he's somewhat unknown, we want to see if we can skyrocket this? I don't think so. I mean, looking at the copy editor, I mean, she seems, she's doing it. Either she's a really good actress.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is a problem, isn't it? We don't know what the absolute truth
is.
But it just feels too suspicious to say that something wasn't done.
Yeah. It's very odd. I mean, because you don't go to print with the wrong copy. I mean, and how many, it just seems a bit dodgy. It really does to me, for sure.
I mean, I think from the angle of what stands out to people, it's interesting you talk about the stunts, and I was thinking about those skateboarders that used to kind of skate off a car off a bridge somewhere and parachute down to the ground.
Yeah,
so the difference there was that they didn't actually damage anything. And
I think also
it was far more authentic. And I think one of the problems with Jacob's thing is that it just felt fake. I mean, I haven't seen the video, but it just, the whole description of what was done, you just put two and two together and it's like, well, it just doesn't feel real. Whereas when they were sliding off on their skateboards over a bridge, pulling their parachute, there was a degree of simplicity and authenticity about that. And I think that's why it worked better.
Well, yeah. And I think the bigger question is, you know, why did he feel the need to go this extra level? You know, what was it? What is in his character that made him decide to take that big of a risk? Why didn't he think through, you know, it's unfortunate. I mean, for him, he's in jail for 6 months and no one's going to want to hire him anytime soon because they're going to be nervous. Like, what's this guy going to do?
Yeah. You know, he's come out with his line to say that this was a humbling experience and stuff like that, but the damage is done.
It's a humbling experience and it's going to take a long time. It's like in Hollywood when, you know, you have like certain actors that were known for drinking or drugging and you couldn't get insurance on them. It was very hard for them to get roles. Even if they're great actors and actresses, they can't get in as quick because nobody wants to take on that liability. He's got liability written all over him right now. So that's going to take a long time to wash off. He's going to have to maybe do a lot of community service for a period of time.
Yeah. You are listening to the Public Relations Podcast with myself, Richard Midson, and Kathleen Nascente from Red Fan Communications. We've got literally just a couple of questions that we're going to have to round up really quickly. Sure. Thanks so much for sending these through to me on LinkedIn. You are welcome to reach out to me either via the publicrelationspodcast.com or you can reach out to me privately on LinkedIn as well. And as usual, I always change the question so that it doesn't identify who you are, the names of who you are, or anything like that. So that it's a completely generic question. But thank you so much for raising these issues. So the first one that we've got here is that I work in a small charity and we're trying to raise the profile of our work. We're getting some press coverage, but how do I prove to the board that what we are doing is working? Kathleen.
All right. I completely understand the challenge here. I'm on a couple of nonprofit boards. And I think that the thing is that you'd have to benchmark a couple of things when you start media relations. So first, who are you competing with in the nonprofit sector? You're always competing for dollars from wallets and visibility. So if you take a look at the others and kind of get a benchmark of the type of press that they're getting and know that you need to at least be mapping to that, it's a good way to measure. I would also take a look at what kind of website traffic you have been getting before you started getting media relations and the type of web traffic you're getting now. And then the other big one is making sure you're taking this and taking all this press coverage and using your social channels and noting how people are engaging with it and also capturing names. You're building a really strong list because your list at the end of the day is your gold when you're a nonprofit. Or a non-profit.
Yes. What doors is it opening? That's one of my key
it's
things.
It's opening up, yeah. Right?
Is it building? How is it advancing that?
Yeah. I also always recommend drafting a letter for board members to be able to send out to the people that they've been trying to get excited about the nonprofit and draft a letter that they can customize with the press coverage and thanking people for donations or inviting them to events that you have coming up.
Next question. The phrase public relations agency is disappearing. Marketing leads are not using the words anymore beyond maybe a few specialist areas. Should we just accept the fact that people are looking to integrated marketing agencies now for all their comms, not PR agencies? Okay. I mean, that's an interesting one again. I mean, my mindset on this, and I've said this throughout the show, is I think PR is a mindset. You know, whatever you want to call it, whether you want to call it marketing, you know, I mean, we're discussing on LinkedIn the other day about the fact that social media is almost identical to PR. It just doesn't mention the word journalist. So I don't think it really matters what it's called anymore, whether you're a marketing agency, communications agency, or whatever. It's still PR is a mindset, and that communication skill to me is going to be more crucial than ever in the next few years because people are tired of simple brand messages. They want stories. They want narratives. They want to feel that they're engaging with a brand. So whatever you call it, maybe the word PR is declining, but I don't think PR itself is going anywhere. In fact, I think it's actually going to grow. What do you think, Kathleen?
I'm with you. I think public relations means stakeholders, speaking to your public stakeholders. And for me, that's even internal stakeholders, right? Because they are part of your public if you're a company. So I think that, unfortunately, if anything, public relations has often been defined too narrowly anyway. And meanwhile, we've all been doing it all along. So it seems kind of silly. People do come out to public relations agencies primarily to get press. But when they usually sit down, if you're asking intelligent questions, you ask them the why behind it, then you tend to realize that there might be media relations for one part of it, but there might be some other channel communications that need to happen at the same time. And that's about reaching those stakeholders and the public. So public relations is not going to go away. And it is often embedded in integrated marketing and communications discussions, or there are agencies that are trying to say they're more than they are. It's a tricky time, but I think most of us are doing way more than media relations. And that's a narrow definition of public relations.
Do you think it's time to drop the phrase public relations?
I think it's time to redefine a number of things. I'm watching most PR agencies struggle with how to define themselves or say that we're much more than a public relations agency, which is the negative of what they are. So it's clearly in flux. It's definitely, it's challenged right now. It's either we need to reposition it. PR needs its own PR game, right? Like it needs the industry. And the challenge with saying you're doing integrated marketing and communications is, well, are you doing all the things? And so what I have found is most communications companies, so Redfan, you'll notice I named it 15 years ago, Redfan Communications, because I knew way out the very beginning that we were going to be doing more than media relations. Well, media relations is the number one reason that people tend to show up at your door.
It's going to be interesting to see how it goes. I just think that communications and having that connection with organizations is just going to be absolutely crucial in the coming year, particularly when more and more the, you know, your stock basic marketing is going to be AI generated. It's that
That's
edge.
Right.
It's having that human nuance that is going to make the difference, I think.
And I think, Richard, one of the things I was just talking about this earlier is that any AI company that I've even spoken to or AI executives, they say, no, you still have to have subject matter experts and you still have to have a really strong editor. Otherwise, you're just producing a lot of the same. And so I think that the companies that are going to stand out the most are going to be ones that have incredible writers and communicators that are helping the subject matter experts really step up. And I think the subject matter expert role should be a role within companies that is 30% of their job, not added on to the CTO role and, you know, extra hours. It should be, it truly is being an evangelist or going out and truly helping to address pain points and communicate as a thought leader. And that is an investment of time.
Kathleen, it's been so pleasurable talking to you today. I've really enjoyed it. And it's so much fun to brainstorm with you and think about ideas together. So thank you so much for your time. It is really appreciated.
I appreciate you having me here.
Tell people again how they can get hold of you.
Please reach out to me at Kathleen@redfancommunications.com. Check out our website, redfancommunications.com. Or look me up on LinkedIn. The last name is Lucente, LUCENTE. First name, Kathleen.
And you've got to come on again, Kathleen.
Okay. I'm ready. Set me up.
I'm looking forward to it. bit later in this year, we will get you on again. Definitely. Thank you so much. Don't forget, you've been listening to the Public Relations Podcast. You can find all the details at thepublicrelationspodcast.com. You can reach out to me on LinkedIn. That's the best place to get hold of me. M-I-D-S-O-N is my surname. It's Richard Midson, M-I-D-S-O-N. Whatever you are up to this week, I hope you have an absolutely fantastic week. We've got another show coming up for you next week. I'm trying to remember who's going to be coming on, but I think it's going to be an absolutely fascinating one. In fact, actually, yes, we are going to be going to India next week to get a perspective on things that are going on there. And I think that's going to be really interesting to hear how the PR world is working in that country. As I say, whatever you're up to this week, have an absolutely fantastic week, and I will speak to you real soon.